This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, with lectures, radio shows, features, and more, available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. On March 29th, 2008, the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression sponsored a panel on the legal questions surrounding academic freedom, affirmative action, and student speech. The program was part of the 14th Annual Virginia Festival of the Book. Professor and author Henry J. Abraham is the moderator of the panel, which covers important issues facing college administrators today.
Good morning. We cannot compete with the Larry Sabato session, but we're not trying to. Is it on? Well, can you hear me?
Yes.
Not better? Okay. I'll try to speak into the microphone, just for a change. I said that we cannot compete with the crowd that graced the presence of Larry Sabato, nor are we going to be as outrageous in some of these recommendations that he presented. What he's doing to my Supreme Court will not fill words, but in any event, it was a lovely session and an overflow crowd. Well, we don't have that. There's a German saying, klein aber fein, which means small but very good or fine. So, all right, so we see that. We're met here in order to discuss the campus client, legal issues in higher education. And the session is sponsored by the Festival of the Books, of course. The legal questions which we're talking about involve academic freedom, affirmative action, student speech, but those are just a few of the issues facing college administrators today. And I hope that you will join this panel of experts for a discussion of some of the legalities involved in providing a college education. They are omnipotent and omnipresent. I hope that you will enjoy listening to some of our experts. I'm not one of them, I'm just a moderator. That's a way out of doing work, so we do that. We thank the Festival of the Books for helping to make this possible, and it's wonderful to recognize the venues and organizations that are appropriate for not only involving the Festival of the Books, but also, of course, the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Freedom of Expression, headed by Bob O'Neill, subheaded by Josh Wheeler. So we are grateful for this opportunity. I will begin by just making a couple of comments about the basic issue, and it may not be completely on the subject, but that's all right, too. In any event, what we're talking about here is about teaching and academic freedom and the atmosphere and the contest between administrators and students. I began my teaching career in 1949, and I've had a love affair with teaching ever since, even if the income from it has been almost entirely psychic rather than financial. But that's all right. I've enjoyed my life as a teacher, and I'm grateful for it. Reflecting on those six decades gives me a pause to point to some of the fundamental changes that have taken place in the universe of students in higher education. Some of these have been positive, others have been negative, and much line drawing is endemic, of course. Let me point to just two on both sides of the line. I like to draw lines, and both sides of the equation can be argued, of course, but on the positive side of developments across the line of these 60 years, one would be I see an abiding acceleration of admission and attendance in the approximately 3,500 institutions of higher education and related thereto a genuine commitment to an increasingly diverse student body, although that has been accompanied by some philosophical and legal wrenching problems centering on the issue of affirmative action, for example, about which you will hear more. But those are two areas on the positive side, the growth and, of course, the diversity that we've mastered. It was quite different when so many of us went to college years and years ago. Now, on the negative side of the line, from my point of view, we find an across-the-board diminution of student discipline, abetted by considerable abdication of administrative involvement and or control, frequently by embracing excessive notions of privacy, which came to a head at the tragedy down in Blacksburg, Virginia, not so long ago. And relatedly again, an unfortunate diminution, as I see it, of ethical and moral commitments by sizable components of contemporary student bodies. Well, those are some reflections which occurred to me in trying to set the tone of some of the changes that have come along. We're very fortunate in having three experts in the general area of education. And in the order of their procedure here, we begin with Professor Robert M. O'Neill, who, as you know, is the head of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Preservation of Free Expression and has had a highly successful career in that capacity. He was president of a number of institutions headed by the University of Wisconsin and the University of Virginia. And furthermore, he was also, of course, thank you, a major figure in the University of California. His books stem from the experiences of those of his former presidency and his present position. He has been an asset to this community. He's been an asset to the whole realm of education, and we're grateful for his commitment and his interest, and we call on him to say a few things.
Thank you, Henry.
Excuse me, because of the pressure of time, we're going to have to limit the panelists to 10 or at the most 12 minutes. We don't have a lot of time here, and we will want questions from the very distinguished and mature audience.
And it's not clear that what we have to say merits any more time. We'll leave that to you. Whenever you can get four academics to agree on a single topic and title, that is noteworthy. In this case, consensus emerged with remarkable facility, clarity, and speed, and that's what brings us together for this occasion this afternoon. What I'd like to do is just to give a very brief synopsis of a book which is not very imaginatively titled Academic Freedom in the Wired World. It was not my decision to put on the cover a picture of a laptop computer with a chain around it and a padlock. That was something that the Harvard University Press devised, and my editor actually apologized. He said, this is the only time I think we've gone out with a cover illustration that we didn't give the author a chance to review and approve. Well, at that point, it was obviously fait accompli, so I've tried to make the best of it, and people ask occasionally. I have various explanations, but I'll spare you those. The book is really in three parts. There is an opening chapter which tries to identify and, in a way, define academic freedom. Then there are eight chapters which deal with specific topics or subjects within the academic universe, such as academic freedom in the courts, academic freedom in time of crisis, national security issues, the arts, research, new technologies, and a chapter toward the end entitled Whose Academic Freedom, about which a bit more in a moment. Then there is a concluding section which attempts to challenge us, the academic community, as to how we might in the future do a more effective job of protecting these interests. Several difficult questions are posed, and in the interest of time, I'll simply pose them at this occasion. For one, what's so special about colleges and universities that merits this degree of protection? And within them, what is so extraordinarily special about professors as the beneficiaries of this protection? Interestingly, my favorite source for the definition and explanation of academic freedom turns out to be none other than Fox News' Bill O'Reilly, who on no fewer than three occasions, without, as far as I can tell, any coercion or provocation, has stepped up as a staunch defender of academic freedom right there in the midst of Fox News. The first time was when I was asked to appear to defend the president and provost of Columbia University in the case of a contentious anthropologist, expecting that Mr. O'Reilly would dump all over me and Columbia. He did dump all over Columbia, I'm sorry to say, but when it came to my view, he said, you know, I agree with you. I don't think we should fire this guy. Then he paused for a moment and said, I think I would not invite him to any faculty things. I was tempted to say, Mr. O'Reilly, many of us wouldn't view that as a sanction. We'd view that as a privilege, but I thought better not to, so I just accepted. And then on two later occasions over a 5 or 6 year period, Bill O'Reilly once again made succinct statements which somehow capture best what needs to be said. A couple of other questions. How do we deal with speech that is not only abhorrent and offensive, but also demonstrably wrong? Well, it turns out to depend largely on the speaker's academic field or discipline. Take, for example, Holocaust denial. If the Holocaust denier is someone like Professor Arthur Butts, an electrical engineering teacher at Northwestern, he essentially gets a pass. That's within his academic freedom. But if we ever came to a time when the Holocaust denier's academic field were modern European history, I don't think there's any doubt that the academic community would come together and say, that is demonstrable incompetence, and given proper procedures, is subject to some sort of sanction up to and including dismissal. A couple of other tough questions. Why do we extend such protection beyond the classroom and the laboratory, indeed beyond the academic setting altogether? If the rationale is primarily to encourage and protect the pursuit of truth and the attainment of knowledge and understanding, does it really make sense to extend protection to a professor's posting on a blog, for example, or in the older days, an outrageous letter to a newspaper? The short answer is yes, although getting there is a bit more difficult. The last of these tough questions is what happens when there are opposed interests. Most of the time in, for example, the University of Michigan race-based admission cases, the institution and its faculty are totally on the same page. Those are harmonious, happy situations. But every so often we get a situation in which the interests of the institution and of the individual are in opposition. Or, in a few recent cases, where faculty and student interests, both reflecting freedom to learn or to teach, come into conflict. With those, we deal somewhat uncomfortably, but there have to be solutions, and those I tried to define. Now, just a word about the concluding chapter. I fear this will probably sound like an Obama speech, but so be it. It is in way in the same spirit. I would urge that the academic left, the liberal component, and it's the dominant component of the academic community, should be much less reluctant to embrace our colleagues at the other end of the political spectrum. Indeed, when I chaired a committee of the American Association of University Professors on Academic Freedom and National Security in time of crisis, in those frightening months after September 11, 2001, we had one resident, honest-to-goodness conservative. Time and again, he provided a reality check. He would say, if you don't acknowledge up front that life in the academic community will never be the same after September 11th, this report will have no credibility. Time and again, he cautioned us, and we took his advice. We were much the better for it. Then I would urge that we as faculty should not only be readier than we typically are to make common cause with administrators, maybe easy for me to say, because I've been an administrator much of my life, but with the university attorney, for example, or the university relations office, or even, perish the thought, the campus police. And in fact, in the draft of this report I mentioned a moment ago, I had specifically urged such acts of rapprochement, fully expecting that my colleagues on that committee would immediately insist such references be removed, saying I can't possibly sign a report that says nice things about university attorneys and campus police. Not a single demurrer within the committee or to this day, and it's now been 2.5 years, not a single demurrer beyond our committee anywhere else in AAUP or, as far as I'm aware, in the academic community. Now, that may mean that nobody's read our report. It's entirely possible. But there must be some people who read it down that far and said, well, you know, things are different since September 11th. Maybe it's not all bad to think in terms of collaborating with people we wouldn't have collaborated with before. A couple of other comments under this heading. Accrediting associations represent a barely tapped potential resource for protecting academic freedom, institutional autonomy, the integrity of university decision-making. In a remarkably few cases, the Association of American Law Schools, the Association of Theological Schools, one or two others have stepped up and have issued cautions or warnings about academic freedom, but it is surprisingly thin. Then I would also urge colleagues, both among faculty and administrators, to be somewhat readier than most of us are to throw the book at those of our colleagues who really have abused academic freedom and have shown irresponsibility through behavior that's just unacceptable. We have a very hard time pointing to those colleagues and, where appropriate, through proper process, essentially excluding them from the academic community. I, as a university administrator, initiated 4 tenure dismissal proceedings, and I have no hesitation in acknowledging that fact. There probably were others where I should have stepped up and initiated a dismissal proceeding, but in at least 4, I did so. That, it seems to me, is an essential component of the responsibility that all of us bear to keep academic freedom alive and well. My last point is, don't take academic freedom for granted. For most of us who never have to invoke it, it's a little bit like the fish who is the last to discover water. It's there, but we don't think anything about it because it's somebody else's issue. Well, every so often, even those of us who feel quite comfortable and secure encounter a moment in which it's helpful to think. In fact, Larry Sabato mentioned this morning, not altogether facetiously, he said, but of course, I have tenure. Everybody laughed and we went on. In fact, he was making precisely that point. Larry has been able freely to do many of the things that he has done, for which all of us are so grateful, for which not just the academic world, but the world of government has been enormously benefited because he is a tenured professor. Now, let me suggest, close with a question to my colleagues. I was trying to think of some theme that cut across what brings all of us here, and it is this. Over the last roughly half century, the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, have formally recognized, defined, and declared commitment and protection for academic freedom as a judicial doctrine. So I was hoping that at some point, Henry might be willing to comment a bit on how that process got started. We understand that Justices Frankfurter and Douglas, for example, they were academics. They came out of the university world. Okay. But eventually, by 1957, there was a pretty clear majority, including some other justices who didn't have the same kind of academic background. Then I hope at some point John Jeffreys might be willing to share his unique insight on why Justice Powell emerged as the principal guardian, sort of mid-course, of academic freedom in the Bakke case, John being not only one of his law clerks, but happily his biographer. No one anywhere understands Justice Powell nearly as well as John does. And finally, because this is very much the subject of her book, I was hoping that Barbara might give some insight on why Justice O'Connor, a generation later, emerged as the guardian and champion of academic freedom, because in her background, there's really nothing that makes that an imperative of the kind that it was, let's say, if you go back to Frankfurter and Douglas. Well, those are some opening thoughts. I look forward to engaging not only among the 4 of us, but with you as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob. By the way, I've been asked to announce that this is a live performance here. We are being broadcast So you may see yourselves either through the medium of the radio or maybe even TV, I don't know. But at any rate, we are under the gun to some extent, time-wise. Thank you for your very succinct and valuable comments, Bob. You usually, in fact, you always have the ability and the wherewithal to hit essentials. Your comments on the problems that academic freedom has faced from time to time brought back to me the days of Joseph McCarthy, when the academic world was in deep, deep trouble, and it did not always emerge with with alacrity in terms of courage. There was a lot of looking over the shoulder. It was a terrible time. The years were in the 1950s, and we were on the balustrades in many ways, and it took some very determined administrators to try to be helpful. The faculty really was intimidated, and in terms of courage, I couldn't give it much more than maybe a C+ during those 2 or 3 years. It was a very, very bad time. And someone who tried to help us at the University of Pennsylvania was, of all people, Harold Stassen, who was running for the presidency at the time. But he fought successfully a loyalty oath which Pennsylvania had required of all of us. And he took up our cause, despite the fact that he wasn't supported 100% by the faculty, and saw to it that he himself could take the responsibility to ascertain that we are not all commies or other pink standard bearers. But he's gone now, and he ran for the presidency about 8 times. But in any event, it was an interesting time and not one to be repeated. I don't think it will be. Our next speaker is Barbara Perry. I'm going to take just a little bit more time because she was a student of mine. And she came to me 25 years ago, and she is now the Carter Glass Professor of Government and founding executive director of the Center for Civic Renewal and the Virginia Law-Related Education Center at Sweetbriar College. And she had a wonderful year at the Supreme Court of the United States as a judicial fellow, and there she received the Tom Clark Award for the Outstanding Fellow that year. Most recently, she was a senior fellow at the Louisville McConnell Center, but she did come back. She has written 8 books, and she heavily in process of about 3 more. Among the 8 books are one that is featured here. It is the Michigan Affirmative Action Cases, which Bob mentioned, and The Priestly Tribe, The Court's Image in the American Mind, and The Supreme's Nice Essays on the Justices. And then she joined me in the 6th edition of Freedom on the Court, for which I've been very grateful. To show you how diverse she is, that's a favorite term, of course, these days. She's currently researching her 2 forthcoming books, Catholics and the Supreme Court, and Rose, Mother of the Kennedy Image. That's Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy. She's a native of Louisville, a great supporter of their basketball team, which seems to be doing fine. And she was a graduate of Louisville and got an MA in politics, philosophy, and economics at the University of Oxford, and then she came to UVA. Barbara?
Thank you, Henry, very much. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. I should say how honored I am to be on this panel with 3 of the most brilliant and renowned constitutional scholars in the country. So it's an honor, and it's a bit daunting as well. Last evening, all of us here on the panel were at a major event here in Charlottesville in honor of Henry Abraham. We have a lecture now that has been established at the University of Virginia Law School, and Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 4th Circuit was the speaker. And so afterwards, Dean Jeffries came up to me and said, "Barbara, I'd like to talk about affirmative action in the panel tomorrow." And I said, "I'm sorry, that's what my book's about, so you can't talk about that." No, I deferred immediately. And so the division of labor will be this. It will be based on our backgrounds and our degrees. Dean Jeffries will talk about the legal issues related to affirmative action, and particularly the consequences, I'm sure, of the Michigan affirmative action cases in 2003. And then I'm also sure from his position as dean of the law school, the implications of that decision and perhaps the future as well. I thought what I would do to take my 10 or 12 minutes this afternoon, since my book is a litigation history of those cases from the University of Michigan, would be, since you're all readers or you wouldn't be here at the Virginia Festival of the Book panel, to put it to you as a cast of characters in a drama, because I think that's the way I, as a political scientist, view it, that these are human stories, as Judge Wilkinson told us last night. I know some of you are in the audience, were there last night. He said as a judge, he remembers always that the people who come to him are human beings with human issues and problems, and we shouldn't get too high up in the clouds or too caught up in the constitutional issues to forget that. So let me just name out for you the groups and the people who were the cast of characters in this case. First of all, arrayed against the University of Michigan and its affirmative action policies were Barbara Grutter, a white, middle-aged woman with a family who had been working in the healthcare field for some years when she decided that she would like to go back to school and get a degree, a law degree, from the University of Michigan Law School. She was a Michigan resident. She had done very well on the LSAT, and she thought that it would be a pretty easy matter to be admitted to the university's law school. She was very disappointed when she did not receive admittance. As it happened, the law school, going back to 1992, she had been turned down in 1997. In 1992, the law school had set up an affirmative action program in which it particularly reached out to underrepresented minorities in the law school, African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans, and tried to use the plus factor that Justice Powell had talked about in the Bakke case, and I know Dean Jeffries will discuss, but tried to use plus as a factor to, in other words, get more minorities into the law school. So when Barbara Grutter found this out and found that there were some minorities with lower test scores, et cetera, she began the process of her litigation. The second person to be a cast of character in the cases was a separate plaintiff, Jennifer Gratz, a younger woman in high school, coming out of high school in a small town in Michigan with a middle-class family. Her parents had not had the opportunity to finish college, but they were Michigan Wolverine fans to the core. They couldn't wait for Saturday football games, and Jennifer Gratz had wished all her life to go to the University of Michigan to the undergraduate program. She applied. She had a 3.8 GPA from her high school. She'd been very involved in extracurricular activities. She didn't have stellar test scores, but she thought that they would certainly be good enough as a resident of Michigan to get into the University of Michigan undergraduate school. She did not. She found out by virtue in part of a philosophy professor named Carl Cohen. He was at the University of Michigan for many, many years and was a self-described liberal Democrat, member of the ACLU, but he realized after he got a Freedom of Information Act request to look at, if you will, the secret documentation of the admissions policies of the law school and the undergraduate school, that they were using affirmative action programs. In fact, for the undergraduate program, they had started out in their effort also to reach out to underrepresented minorities, African Americans, Latinos, as well as Native Americans, that they would have a two-track system, if you will. They'd have one pool for the underrepresented minorities, and they'd have another pool for all the other people applying, and they would have two different standards. Once the litigation started, they changed that to a point system that was 150 points would be the top point total you could get, and a bonus point, 20 points, in fact, were given if you were an underrepresented minority. So that was the challenge as it came to the U.S. Supreme Court. The other characters involved in this come from the Center for Individual Rights, a conservative public interest law firm. Public interest law firms have been around a long time. Democrats and liberals had used them for a long, long time. We know, for example, about the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And so conservatives were sort of late to the game, but they realized this is a way to change policy. You don't always have to go to the legislature, go to the courts. So the Center for Individual Rights, which had already been successful in challenging the affirmative action program at the University of Texas Law School, began trolling for litigants, if you will, and found Jennifer Gratz and eventually Barbara Grutter. So they helped to bring the case all the way to the Supreme Court. Obviously, on the other side, the cast of characters begin with the University of Michigan, which is going to defend its programs. Many Fortune 500 companies, which sent in friend-of-the-court briefs to say how much they supported affirmative action programs in our nation's universities and professional schools because they believe that diversity in those schools helps to create a diverse workforce and helps then the companies to deal with a diverse global society. And finally, retired generals from the Army and retired admirals from the Navy sent in a joint front of the court brief to say how important it is to have a diverse military in this country. You add to this mix two justices, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and a justice who was deceased by 5 years at this point, Justice Lewis Powell. And here's how they all came together. The case comes to the Supreme Court. Henry and I were very lucky to be able to go to the oral argument on that April the 1st, 2003 it was. I'll never forget. So it's just a few years ago at this very time. And for April, it was awfully chilly in the morning, and I remember being bundled up in a coat and standing next to the president of the University of Michigan, who was very interested in how this oral argument was going to go. I have a whole chapter in my book that acts as a play-by-play and color commentary on the oral argument, and I think it's the best chapter in the book. But I'll just cut to the chase. It was Sandra Day O'Connor, not surprisingly, who cast the deciding vote, as she often did in cases such as this. She had a majority of five, which she led in the Grutter case, the law school case, to say, going back to Justice Powell's Bakke decision, that to use race as a plus to get to a diverse student body was a compelling state interest, and as long as the program was narrowly tailored, as the court says, it passed constitutional muster and did not violate the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. So she had five votes for that. She, however, was on the other side in the Grotz case, and the vote was 6-3 in that instance, to say that the undergraduate college, by having their point system and giving out bonus points to certain minorities, that that was a violation of equal protection. And so that's the way the cases came down in 2003. A final point for Justice O'Connor. At the very end of her opinion, she added this odd paragraph about, well, perhaps we'll only need these kinds of programs for 25 more years. Well, we're 5 years down the road, so we have 2 decades left if that's where we're going. But as a matter of fact, in Michigan itself, The plans, and Justice O'Connor's opinion only lasted several more years because in 2006, in a referendum, the voters of Michigan decided by a fairly substantial majority that they did not wish to have affirmative action in school admissions, in government contracts, or in hiring, government hiring. So while Justice O'Connor's legacy in most of the states still remains, and we'll turn things over now to Dean Jeffries to talk about that, in Michigan, the very state where the case came from, it is no longer the law.
Thank you, Barbara. Succinct, as always. well rehearsed. Practically no notes. Excellent. You were well trained.
I was going to say, I learned from the master.
That is called onanism. But in any event, our final speaker in the formal session is John Jeffries, who is now in his last year as dean of the law school of the University of Virginia. That's his seventh year, I think.
Yes, sir.
He's a very distinguished member of the law school, has been for a long time, and he's also been on the battlefront in taking cases to the Supreme Court. I was privileged to sit in that wonderful hall when he argued a case involving the University of Virginia, namely Rosenberger versus Virginia. In any event, that was an issue which dealt with both the First Amendment and separation of church and state. It was a very, very closely divided court. It was a 5-4 decision. I'm afraid to say that John lost, but he might have gotten points anyway. That's part of psychic income, too, you see, even if you lose. I might also point out that John is the author of a magnificent book about Justice Powell. So far, it's the only biography. But he had a relatively easy time because he had a prince of men. He was a wonderful man, and he was quite willing to grant interviews to John. And I don't think he read the book until it was finished. I'm now told there is question whether he read it at all. But he certainly was a wonderful subject, and I'm proud to say he was a friend. He was just a wonderful person. I'm so sorry he stepped down. John, he also has another book, which is called Civil Rights Actions Enforcing the Constitution, which he wrote with Pamela Carlin, Peter Lowe, and George Rutherglen, all members at one time of the faculty of the law school. But Carl and Lo are no longer on the faculty there. John, would you please hold forth? Mm-hmm.
Henry, thank you very much. I have to say that insofar as one derives a psychic income from losing cases, I think psychic income is overrated. It's an experience I intend to repeat if I can help it. Barbara Perry's remarks gave you some taste of her wonderful book on the Michigan affirmative action cases. It is a terrific book, both because it brings a sophisticated argument and depth of detail about the public issues together with a story about individuals and their perspectives and their backgrounds and how their lives showed up in their decisions and in their arguments. And the melding of that human story with the law is accomplished in that book as well as I've ever seen it done. I commend it to your attention. Looking out in the future, I do not see a great range of problems facing higher education, but the Mount Everest of the problems coming down the track is the one Barbara Perry has identified for us, which is affirmative action. Affirmative action is a huge issue in some institutions. It probably bears emphasis that there are a great many educational institutions in this country in which race-conscious admissions are not much of an issue because, to be frank, most applicants get in. But for elite institutions of higher education, I don't say elitist, but those that are highly selective, race-conscious admissions continue to be a very prominent issue. And I'd like to say just a word about what that looks like from inside the academy. Let me preface that word by acknowledging that this is an issue of extraordinary depth of commitment on both sides, and people of good sense and goodwill can and do disagree. That's true in my law school and in other law schools around the country. It's certainly true on the Supreme Court. It very likely is true in this room and on this panel. So there are a wide range of opinions that are deserving of respect here. But I thought maybe it would be useful for you to hear what it looks like from, if you will, in the trenches. The University of Virginia Law School now, I'm proud to say, has a remarkably competitive admissions environment. When I'm on the road talking to alumni, the most common comment I hear is, boy, I sure am glad I went to school then because I couldn't get in now. And I spend a good deal of my time trying to find a really polite way to say, yes, that's true. There are many of us, myself included, who would have a hard time getting in the door today. And on objective criteria, the tests that one takes and that result in numerical scores, which can be compared down to the decimal point to those of other people. In those objective criteria today, our entering class is somewhere between the 97th and 98th percentile of all those people who take the LSAT and try to go to law school. That's the median performance, somewhere between the 97th and 98th, which, if I can remember my fifth grade math, means that half the class is better than the 98th percentile. They are a remarkably qualified group. In a class as selective as that, for whatever reason, and I don't pause to talk about what the reasons likely are. We all have some sense of them, and yet they're deeply controversial, too. But in a class as selective as that, for whatever reason, a strictly numerical admissions policy would produce a class that had almost no African Americans. That's the reality with which we are faced. In the 20th century, I can't speak for the 21st, it may be that 9/11 will come to be the defining theme of the 21st century in some sense. But for the 20th century, the great spine of American constitutional law was race. Over and over and in every context, the Supreme Court came back to race. And race was the defining issue, not only in civil rights cases, which we all know about, but in so many other areas as well. The entire criminal procedure revolution is really a response to racial injustice in the South as much as it is anything else. Many of the great free speech cases that Bob O'Neill knows so much about had their origins in concerns that touched on race. It is the dominant theme of the 20th century in American constitutional law. As a teacher, I can't imagine impoverishing our classrooms by having that discussion limited to whites. That's not a plea for special treatment of anyone. It's a plea for the educational value of what we do. And it is my belief that the education of every student in our classrooms, white, African-American, Asian, Hispanic, whatever, that the education of every student is enhanced by having in the room a diverse group of students. So that when you're talking about the issues of great controversy, about which people can, do, and should disagree, when you're talking about the values that define what kind of country we want to be, and those values are contested, and we're trying to search for what our future should be, that conversation needs to be comprehensive and inclusive. From where I sit, that's what affirmative action means in higher education. What are its chances of surviving the next few terms of the Supreme Court? Well, I don't know about that. I guess I think it's very, very iffy. But I thought it worth saying, and I say it often, that the essential rationale for race-conscious admissions isn't a notion of repaying past wrongs. It's not a notion of disadvantaging some perfectly innocent white applicant in order to repay a debt to somebody else from another generation. That's not the point at all. The point is to provide the best possible education for every student in that classroom. And in my judgment, that justifies what we do. If I may just add one final comment, I also have to say I don't think we should ever feel entirely comfortable about this. You know, racial preferences are a dangerous thing. And even if they are, as they seem to me, justified in this context, we ought to approach them cautiously with the desire to withdraw from them as soon as possible. It's my hope that Justice O'Connor will have been right or perhaps even pessimistic, and that long before her 25 years are up, this issue will have moved to the back burner. Well, I can't say nearly enough about Barbara's book, except that you'll learn a lot more reading it than you will from listening to me.
Well, it seems my colleagues have behaved very well indeed. They kept within the framework of time. And I suppose we could go to questions. There is a gentleman in the back with a microphone. And if you have any kind of questions, we'd be happy to entertain them. I might add, as an aside, the issue we're discussing today is based on the problem of higher education. That issue is just as prevalent and certainly as pregnant, if I can use that term, in the schools below. And the last two Supreme Court decisions on about affirmative action at the level of the high schools and perhaps even below high schools came to us a year or so ago in a case I had the privilege of listening both to the oral argument and to the decision which came down, which was featured by a 77-page oral dissent by Justice Breyer, who caressed every word and kept us in our seats for half an hour. But in any event, these were 5-4 votes, as is so frequently the case. They dealt with the question of the school boards of Louisville, Kentucky, and Seattle, Washington. There was no charge that there was any kind of racial discrimination based on the concept of discrimination as we think of it. But because of the housing pattern, among other things, the schools were beginning to be again segregated, which is a wrenching issue, and for one, if there may be no solution at all. Well, Seattle, which had never been charged with discrimination, decided that in applications for transfers or even for admission, they would use a formula which classifies students into white and non-white. Now, What does this mean in terms of the famous dissenting opinion of Mr. Justice John Marshall Harlan in a losing cause, 7-1, in 1896 in Plessy versus Ferguson, that the Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens? That was a case which created, for a period of approximately 65 years, the upholding of segregated schooling. In the Louisville situation, they had been under the gun for discriminating. They had accommodated that, and they were no longer charged with that. But they, too, used admissions and transfer on the basis of whether or not the individual was white or non-white. Now, what does that do to affirmative action? Well, the court, in two very narrowly decided opinions, held that both school boards had discriminated the control against non-whites by classifying individuals on the basis of white or black or non-white or minority or majority. The decisive vote in the cases was cast by Justice Kennedy, who loves to be the decision maker in the Supreme Court decisions. In the last term of court, he won all 24 5-4 cases. And he lost only two cases among the 76 or so which were handed down. He's not going to maintain the same record because he already lost one 5-4 case. But he is still at the center of the storm, the center of the eye. Well, he gave hope to the school boards, and they've already begun to accept it. He said, you cannot do what you have done, but you can take into account other questions and other characteristics, such as the housing pattern to some extent, such as income, the poverty problem, and so forth. So the school boards were given additional help. But in the final analysis, the constitutional issue on which these cases were decided was a precedent, stare decisis, as the lawyers call it, to Brown versus Board of Education, which pointed out that separate educational facilities were inherently unequal and that race could not be used. Well, that gives you a picture of the problem, of the wrenching problem of the affirmative action program, behind which, of course, there looms another interesting philosophical issue. What about merit? Shouldn't merit be paramount? Yes, but we heard Dean Jeffries point out, if we did that, we would probably exclude a good many of applicants from minority groups. And how that is to be accommodated is another interesting issue. It's a terrible problem. But the Chief Justice, in delivering the majority opinion in one of the two cases, referred to Brown v. Board of Education, held that this was a denial of the equal protection of the laws. And he said, the way to stop discrimination is not to discriminate. And so the cases were submitted. But it just shows you, although this is not at the higher level of education, but the subsidiary level, which in many ways is even more important, it shows you the wrenching problem with which we're dealing. We all have views, we all have opinions on it. And it does make a difference who is on the court, and it does make a difference as to the perception of justices have with respect to the parameters of power. Do they legislate or do they judge? Well, that's a much bigger issue. But since I had the microphone and no one could stop me, I thought I'd bring that out. Now, please, let's go to questions, if there are any. If you, please. Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you mentioned the high school cases because I was sitting here trying to remember what I had read. I know I was very disturbed when I read. I'd forgotten there were two. And I guess I'm still a little bit confused. I remember Brown versus Board of Education, separate is inherently unequal. Mm-hmm. What I didn't understand in those high school cases in the last year was it felt to me like the Brown case was being undermined. So I guess I'm confused. You said something about Brown said race could not be a factor.
Well, Brown said the Brown case was based on the fact that we had separate education facilities right. for blacks and whites. And right. Chief Justice Warren, in handing down a unanimous opinion for the court, which was such a wrench that he waited 2 years until he had a court. And he had to sit on Felix Frankfurter, who was all in favor of the outcome of the case, but he wanted to read the Riot Act to his ex-law students in the South, and he had to wait for a year or so until he could write a concurring opinion. Warren wanted a totally, totally unanimous court, and he got it. And the last one to come aboard was Justice Reed of Kentucky, whom Chief Justice Warren took to 20 lunches. And after the 20th lunch, Reed said, "I will do it for America," you see. Separate education facilities based on race are inherently unequal. That was the view in Brown versus Board, and Brown versus Board is still with us in many ways. There have been tremendous advances. We forget how much we have really accomplished. But, of course, you know, Nirvana has not yet arrived, and it may not arrive soon.
I'm still confused, though, because I think a lot of our schools are as segregated, or in some cases more segregated than they were in the 60s. So I'm still confused about, I guess, maybe I have an incomplete understanding of Brown versus Board of Education, but my thought was that these, at least one of those high schools, I think the Louisville one, was trying to get a diverse population.
Well, they were, but in part that was ran into the housing patterns. You also have this problem of busing based on racial considerations, you know, which a good many advocates of affirmative action do not like and do not approve of. So what you're categorizing is just another illustration of the very, very difficult role that the affirmative action program poses. And those people who are resolutely committed to merit and nothing else, you know, feel they have a strong point. It's the only thing that could count is, can you achieve the required intellectual competence?
Thank you.
Just to add a footnote, if I can, there was much concern in the higher education community when those decisions were announced, fearing that the court had somehow undermined Grutter, as well as Brown and other elementary secondary cases. But I think it's fair to say that the majority in the Seattle-Louisville cases went to considerable lengths, at least expressly, to preserve the rationale of Grutter, one which, of course, does not really apply to elementary and secondary education. But there are very much two schools now on that issue. How concerned, how prophetic should one feel the court was in the Seattle-Louisville cases. Moreover, there is one immediate downside for higher education, and that is if the secondary schools are less able to achieve diversity in their classes, that further undercuts the efforts of colleges and universities to recruit and enroll diverse classes at the post-secondary level. There's no doubt about that. On the legal question, the constitutional question, I guess we'd say the jury's still out.
Henry, may I add a word? May I?
Please.
I thought your question is very apt, and it points out a deep irony about the condition of secondary education in America today. Brown versus Board of Education said that state required separation by race is unconstitutional. Now, that stopped a long time ago. And we do not today have state-required racial segregation. But because of the difference in the racial makeup of communities, many of our public schools are, in fact, largely segregated. Look at the city of Richmond. City of Richmond public schools are overwhelmingly African American. Now, what's the cause of that? Well, it's because the city of Richmond is one unit, Henrico County is another unit, Chesterfield County is a third unit. People live in those communities and go to school separately in those communities. And the student population in the city of Richmond is overwhelmingly black. The student population in Henrico County is overwhelmingly white. So even though the state supported and required segregation, which was the shame of our country, has long since been left behind, the desegregation of education is still an ongoing project.
John, could I just add a question to you? To what extent, in your view of him, Justice Powell's experience on the Richmond School Board affected, if at all, his Bakke opinion?
Lewis Powell was the head of the Richmond School Board, as Bob has just mentioned, and at a later time he was head of the Virginia State Board of Education, and he was also on college boards. He had a deep commitment to education. And how did that affect Bakke? Honestly, Bob, I don't know. I don't think Powell's experience in education affected his views about affirmative action nearly so much as his experience as a Southerner. His experience as a Southerner. If you grew up in Wisconsin, you might think that we could get beyond the problems of race by declaring them over. But you would not have that misconception if you grew up in Richmond, Virginia.
Could I add an anecdotal irony on the Louisville case, and as a native of Louisville, as Henry mentioned, that I am and an alum of the University of Louisville, and I'd much rather be talking about basketball here, but we
talk
are in.
While you can.
I talk while I can, yes, Dean Jeffries, thank you. But there you have it. The irony is that one of the original plaintiffs in the Louisville case was an African-American woman who lived in a primarily African-American neighborhood in Louisville that is home to a school called Central High School, which in the days before Brown was the designated black school for the city of Louisville. All blacks, wherever they lived, had to go to that school and could go to that school only. In fact, it's the alma mater of Muhammad Ali. It is now a superb magnet school. So it draws from all over. Louisville is now metro government combined, Louisville and Jefferson County. And it's a magnet for government and law. And this woman who lived in the neighborhood wanted to send her son there, but was being told that because there needed to be more diversities in the schools, he needed to go to a suburban school that would have been mostly white if blacks from the inner city were not sent there. So she and then white plaintiffs, parents of white students who were not getting to go to their neighborhood schools either in this plan, brought the cases and ended up all the way at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Bakke, which Dean Jeffries mentioned, was one of the cases Justice Powell was very proud of. And after he had retired, I had a chance to ask him. He was never willing to speak about cases while he was on the bench. But after he retired, I could do that. And I asked him, which was your favorite opinion? He said, Bakke. And I said, why? Because it's been followed. Well, it hasn't been followed. You know, it's only been followed in part. But Bakke, Alan Bakke was an applicant to a brand new medical school in Irvine, California. The school was 3 years old. If it had intended to discriminate, it didn't have enough time to do so. And it was not about to. Californians are usually pretty good about that anyway. It's a miserable state in some ways, but anyway, it's not in this case.
I'd like to dissent for that, in case anybody's watching from Los Angeles.
The administrators of this new medical school of the University of California took 100 new students, new medical applicant students. However, they put aside 16 for non-white applicants. And one of the non-white applicants was Alan Bakke, who went to court saying this was rank discrimination, rank violation of previous decisions. Bakke, in a 5-4 decision by Justice Powell, agreed and said that you could not have rigid quotas of that type, that these were violative of the United States Constitution, 14th Amendment, as separation, I mean, sorry, equal protection of the laws, and perhaps the Fifth Amendment, which is the federal level, they would have to use due process of law. But Powell went beyond that particular facet of the decision. But he held that given the necessity of accommodating varied applicants, he created something that would be known as diversity, that schools had a right to try to find and to perpetuate an interest in a diverse campus. And he said that means that non-white students, and that was his term, could expect it to be given a plus in the consideration, you see. He said that would be acceptable. And that held for a long, long time. And to some extent, I suspect it is still regarded as being acceptable. But you can see the difficulty of handing down these decisions. Another interesting aspect of that case, one of the most liberal jurists on the current bench is Justice Stevens. He's the senior associate justice. He was appointed by a Republican president. He was a Republican. His voting has all been liberal democratic on most issues. Justice Stevens dissented from the initial Powell opinion, which created the concept of a plus. But through the years, he's now in his 33rd year, he changed his mind, you see. And he would now be counted upon, as indeed he was in the cases that Dean Jeffries mentioned, he could be counted upon as a bona fide supporter of affirmative action. So that brings in another feature, you see, and brings in the issue that Larry Sabato has in his book. Namely, he wants to reduce Supreme Court justices' tenure to 15 years, which I think is a terrible plan. But in any event, and he also wants to put an age limit on it. Just think what that would do to the memory of Justices Holmes and Brandeis and Black and Stevens. Now, he's still up there. He's 87. He doesn't need memory. He plays tennis, but he's in good shape.
I had a question.
Yes, sir.
If we could go back to academic freedom for a moment. I was wondering if, and I would address this to all members, if there has been any sensing of intimidation on the faculty, on today's faculties, particularly by any particular cultural or religious groups, in response to restrictions that have resulted from either the legislative branch's response to 9/11 or the executive branch's response to 9/11 in terms of invasive types of laws and restrictions that have been promulgated.
May I call on you, Bob, to respond?
I would say far less in terms of governmental pressure than those of us with vivid memories of the McCarthy era would have expected. In fact, in the first few weeks after the hijacking and the terrorist attacks, what most of us would have feared simply didn't materialize. And even in some fairly challenging situations, institutions seemed to have got the message. And they would suspend an outspoken faculty member while conducting an investigation, and at the end of the investigation, the person was typically reinstated. What has happened, however, is pressure from private groups, which has had, in some cases, precisely the effect that you describe. CampusWatch.org, NoIndoctrination.org. Now we have Juicy Campus, which is really a totally different situation that's much more extreme and probably lacks credibility. Unfortunately, some of these privately maintained, posted, and operated websites like No Indoctrination and Campus Watch have enough credibility, even though they are largely anonymous, that they do serve to intimidate. There is no way in which anyone can measure the extent to which American faculties have responded in politically correct ways to avoid ending up on Campus Watch or No Indoctrination. But one senses that there has been at least some trend in that direction. What's, of course, most troubling is that there is no legal recourse of any kind because the people who post and maintain these websites or blogs are engaging in their own totally protected freedom of expression. That's what makes it tough.
Please.
Mm-hmm. I'm a Michigan resident and a University of Michigan Law School graduate, and I'm very ashamed of my fellow voters for approving that constitutional amendment that Dr. Perry mentioned. In light of a state like Michigan approving something like that, has there been a movement in other states to try to adopt such provisions?
Mm-hmm. Yes, a number of states. Particularly after that case was handed down in 2003, made a move in that direction. You might be familiar with the name Ward Connerly, who was on the California Board of Regents, governing the California state system, who's a very interesting African-American businessman, a very successful businessman. He happened to come to the McConnell Center last year, and we had a very interesting dialogue with him about his views on affirmative action, and he is very much against it and was instrumental in having a referendum along the lines of the one that was in Michigan and successful in 2006 in California. I think the state of Washington had one shortly after that that was also successful in banning affirmative action within the state realm. And he has looked at other states, and again, sort of part of this movement of interest groups, which I do find fascinating, again, as a political scientist, looking at constituencies and interest groups and how they use the court system, or in this instance, how they use our democratic system of referenda. And so that's where part of the pushback, or blowback, as they say in the military, is coming from.
All right, please.
Thank you. Well, I just have to make a quick comment. I'm kind of appalled at what looks like a lack of students here. I'm not even a student, and so I'm just kind of wondering where all the, if it's about academic freedom, where all the university students are in our town. But my question...
They're exercising their freedom.
Yes. There we go. Which is fine. But my question is along the lines more about language that we're using in these cases. And I keep hearing the term non-white come up. And I know, at least within my generation, there seems to be somewhat of a shooing of playing the identity politics game necessarily when it comes to identifying as a single race, as checking your box. And I just wonder where you see cases that are going to continue to crop up, obviously, about affirmative action going, if the way that we speak about race and our language is starting to change, or is it changing even within these cases? How do you see the language that we use in general to speak about affirmative action?
You're quite right, I think, about the about a shift in the way young people think about themselves. Ethnic identity is self-declared in higher education. That is, students have an opportunity to say what they are. And we see every year an increase in the number of students who say none of the above. So in our class of 360 in the law school, probably 60 or 65 students are undeclared. That's a change, and it probably reflects the kind of sensibility of your generation that you were describing.
I just add that I think we, too, lament the lack of students. We had thought of advertising this session as devoted to March Madness. But it would have been a little hard to explain, so we take it from there. Another example of the complexity of the current situation, my middle son's and his wife's, their closest friend at Harvard Law School, classmate, was clearly African-American, grown up in an African-American community in New York City. He did not, but his older brother, aggressively identified himself as white or Caucasian throughout college and law school, apparently to be certain that he was not viewed or given any special consideration as a minority. There are also complications about the status of other minority groups, Asian most especially, groups that are not only typically not underrepresented, but in the normal course of things may end up being overrepresented. And yet, is it fair to give no consideration to racial differences, which in some ways do affect Asian American students? These are among the very complex issues that are only really now coming into focus.
I'd like to raise another issue of academic freedom and diversity, in quotes. The University of Virginia Faculty Senate did an extensive survey last year of the entire faculty on all sorts of issues and released their report about a month ago. And they referred in the report in a sort of a positive way that we need to be conscious of various kinds of diversity, including race and gender and sexual orientation, but they also mentioned political diversity. And this brings to mind that in this year's state legislature, House Bill 110 was introduced and is modeled after a bill that's being introduced in all sorts of states and has a name something like Defense of Academic Freedom Act. And as I understand it, would require academic institutions to report regularly to SHEV, the State Council on Higher Education, about the extent of the political diversity in their classrooms or something like that. So many of us fear these kinds of acts as being real threats against academic freedom and not protections of them in responses to the perceived liberal bias of academia.
They are certainly not, for the most part, from friendly sources. They have been closely monitored by several organizations. I've been involved in that process. Thus far, none has actually been enacted into law. In two states, they have passed one house of the state legislature, but failed to pass the other house. The experience recently in Virginia, it didn't, as I recall, didn't even get out of committee. So it was essentially moot. But the sponsor in the last session has already indicated an intent to revive the process in the next session. I doubt that such efforts will abate or subside. I think they will continue. My hope and expectation is that none will actually become law because, again, this is a problem of remedies that lawyers worry a lot about. There is probably no viable legal recourse against the so-called Academic Bill of Rights or whatever its title, should it actually become law, because it doesn't really affect or doesn't require anyone to do anything to anyone of the type that creates a legally remediable injury. So I think if any of them does pass, it'll be sort of hanging out there as a cloud or an omnipresent threat without being subject to judicial challenge, which is worrisome.
We have time for one more question. I think the two ladies here, you may fight for them.
I'll be quick and you can get one. All right. Considering that this constitutional issue is in flux, do you have any opinion as to the present court's feeling about what cases they might select or if they have a persuasion to go a certain way?
Well, what cases they select is up to them. It takes four, normally. There are some exceptions, but you should remember, unless there are four justices who want to hear a case, with very few exceptions, that's what you get. If you can't find four, it took a long time for the justices in the 70s to accept an affirmative action case. Mm-hmm. And I remember one stinging dissenting opinion by Justice Douglas dissenting from the denial of granting the writ of certiorari to hear the case. Would have been an affirmative action case involving a young man by the name of De Funès. So unless you can find, now, why do they grant here? Sometimes they grant because lower courts decided cases on different grounds and received different outcomes. Or perhaps some people are very eager to adjudicate a case which might have a major issue of civil liberties. Others might not want to get involved in that. And we have illustrations of a number of affirmative action cases or potential affirmative action cases, some from Texas, where the liberals were not eager to accept the case because they were afraid there might be five conservative votes. Of course, I'm oversimplifying between liberal and conservative. I don't like the dichotomy, but I don't know what else we can use. So the justices, with very rare exception, as I said, do not have to take any case they don't want. Even in original jurisdiction, which covers just two areas, you know, when states are a party or when a foreign official is a party, even there, there is an obligation, apparently, to take the case. But what they do is they may take the case and then they buck it down below lower federal courts to handle it. So this is part of the politics of accepting cases. When I went to college 100 years ago, and the court took 150 cases. Now it takes only about 75 or 80. It receives 9,500 applications for review. So it has a tough role to play. And it depends in part on the Chief Justice. Chief Justice Stone used to examine every petition for certiorari, and his sessions were endless. Chief Justice Hughes would pile up a whole bunch of petitions for certiorari with which the justices, in theory, were familiar. And I would say, here is a group of petitions, there are 40. Unless someone objects, they're all denied. See, so that is part of the judicial process, too, and it's an interesting one. Well, I'm afraid our time has come to terminate. We thank you very much indeed for your attentiveness, and we thank the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which, of course, renders possible the organization of the Festival, Virginia Festival of the Books. You were highly attentive. You get a very high grade, and you may win. You may win. Thank you.
It's nice to see you.
Good to see you, and thank you so much for your time.